Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey y'all, it's Jacqueline getting closer to the new Unscrewed season launch, but I have another treat for you in the interim. This is the interview I did last month on the Bad Christian podcast. I talked to Bad Christian once before. It's a group of white Southern guys who are unpacking what they learned growing up in the evangelical church and trying to figure out what they still believe and what's bogus bullshit. And they're really great and fun, and I love talking to them because they have a completely different perspective than I do, but they're really genuinely open to dialogue and learning and exchange. And so it leads to some challenging conversations, but also keeps me on my toes, and I learn a lot about how they're thinking, and it's just a really great show. You can just put Bad Christian into your podcast app wherever you are and find them. And in the meantime, check out this interview I did with them last month, which it manages to tie together the Jews Against ICE protests I participated in this summer, and voting, and sex ed, and a whole bunch of other stuff in like a neat little bow by the end. I was pretty pleased with myself, if I do say so. So have a listen, and also don't forget, coming up is my Boston live show at the Podcast Garage on September 19th. Those tickets are free, but you do want to reserve them so you have a spot. You don't want to miss out if they sell out. So go to JacquelineFriedman.com and check out my events page for all the details there, and I hope to see you there. In the meantime, enjoy the show.
Have you been doing a lot of press and podcasts lately?
I actually have. I wasn't for a while, and my show's on summer hiatus, but I just did Call Your Girlfriend, and I just did the new Bitch Magazine pod. I've been surprisingly doing a lot of these lately.
That's great.
I like being a guest on other people's shows. It's so much less work.
Yeah, I know. It's the best. And we're already rolling, by the way, if everybody's comfortable, if y'all are rolling stuff. But I love being on other people's podcasts, too, because there's no pressure. And I know already that they want me to show out a little bit. Like, they asked me on because they like my personality or something. So here you go. Like, you asked for it. I feel so free.
Exactly.
And when I do this podcast, I have to manage. I feel like, you know, so presumptuous. I'm the host. It's my show. I want to talk about me. Like, that, you know, that's hard.
Exactly. So I was thrilled.
Well, that's what.
Also, yeah. I had so much fun talking to you guys last time. So.
Yeah, well, we had a big response. That's what I was going to say, too. I think that's like even having you back is really fun for us, because we had a great response, especially in our BC club, about just how many people really appreciate your point of view and the way, you know, just your open mindedness and all that stuff. But it was funny, even you're talking about going on other people's show. I even watched a few like YouTube and interviews just to refresh myself of where you're at now with some stuff. And you have so much information and knowledge to bring that is. I think the people, the shows you go on to, it's easy for them too. I really do believe that. Like the nicest thing in the world is when you have a guest on and you know they're bringing something and can talk, and you got all that for sure. And it's just so nice, and it feels easy. Like, it's not like work. So some of the people that interviewed you that I was watching, it was really funny. Like, I was like, how you are carrying this segment unbelievably well. So it's pretty cool.
Well, so yeah, what should we talk about today?
Well, I wanted to start with purity culture. Is an area that is just kind of real interesting. I mean, there's always stuff going on in it, and I really feel the public frame shifting on that. And I think what's interesting is part of what makes the good for you to be on the show is we come from different backgrounds and are even in different places. I think that's what feels so good is an exchange of information there and seeing how much we have changed in the community we represent. They've shifted a ton on purity culture and now are way closer to a much more open-minded and liberal view. So it's really good to check back in with people and go, oh, we're closer together now. We've changed. We moved a little bit here. And now some of these other ideas I used to think were scary are not scary. I mean, I used to be closer to an abstinence guy. And that kind of stuff seems so nonsensical to me now. So that's kind of where I wanted to engage there. I know you've done a lot of work about sex ed and sex ed in schools. And, so that's the topic that I'm kind of interested in to begin with.
Yeah, I will talk about sex ed in schools all day long. I mean, look, just to be clear for everyone listening and so we can define terms, I am all for abstinence as a personal choice, right? That people mm-hmm. who feel like abstinence is the right call for them in whatever circumstance they're in or for whatever reasons make sense to them, I think that's great and they're ahead of the game because so many people I talk to don't know what they want when it comes to sex, right? And feel confused and overwhelmed. And so if you feel clear that what you want on a personal level is abstinence, I am all for that. What I'm not for is telling everybody that's the right, that's the one size fits all solution.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think especially growing up in church, that's one of the things I've wondered because it was taught in school the same way. The best sex is to wait. You know what I mean? And now I was in elementary school in the 80s. So maybe some of that has changed. My kids haven't really had my oldest now Ruby is 9 and they haven't really gotten into sex education at the schools yet. I'm wondering what that will look like and what questions she'll have. But is the underlying thing you think with purity culture, when I think of the term purity culture, I think wait till marriage because God wants you to. That's what I've always thought. But now, even thinking it, and y'all bringing up the education aspect of it, that was taught kind of in school too, that school the best sex is to wait for a partner that you're in love with, most likely married to, and then have sex. And if you don't, either maybe you're a slut, maybe you're a sleaze bag, maybe you're really rotten or something like that. And that stuck with me. I still feel that way sometimes. Like Matt, same way as you said, I think I was probably abstinence, even though I felt like, okay, I would have oral sex and then I would just ask God to forgive me. I was like, why am I having oral sex? Why shouldn't I be a better person? Why am I doing this? And so my answer to it always was, oh, I'm a sinner. I'm weak. It was Satan. Maybe it was the girl's fault that we fooled around with, all the worst possible answers instead of thinking about my own sexuality.
That was just almost never. Yeah.
That almost never popped in my head. How crazy is that?
And there's so many things that flow from that are damaging to all of us. One is obviously the sexist ways in which that gets implemented in real life. When we talk about purity culture, what we're talking about is a fixation specifically on female virginity, right? And that women are impure. And oftentimes, like you said, if men are sexual with women or young men or boys, right? We blame the women anyway, right? We say it's your responsibility not to tempt men. Men are weak. You can't expect them. It's like it all falls on women. It's about controlling women's behavior and blaming and stigmatizing women most of the time, which is not to say that it doesn't damage men. Obviously, you just said you've suffered with it. But also the thing that perplexes me so much is how we think we can tell young people not to even think about sex, right? Because that's the ideal for purity culture, right? That not only that you're not doing anything sexual, but that your thoughts are pure too, right? Which is literally impossible. It's setting everybody else up to feel bad and shameful. And when we feel bad and shameful, then we're easily controlled, right? So you can draw your own conclusions from that. But also, how are we suddenly supposed to be functional, healthy, sexual adults when we finally get married or whatever Rubicon is that we're supposed to make sex okay? If we're supposed to keep young people growing up in absolute purity from any sexual thoughts, and then we're going to flip some light switch and then you're ready to be an actual mature adult around sex, we're not preparing anybody to be a good sexual citizen.
Yes, no. Completely absurd. If you frame it in those terms, and the way I look at parenting or child development is just so simple. It's practice.
Yes.
That's all it is. That's what it's for. I mean, that's why you're interested. You just, there's nothing else really. It's not, you don't have a kid to explain the rules to it and what to do. That is not really what's going on. It's practicing being a human until you can do it by yourself. So to deny one of the most fundamental biological driving processes that is completely one of the biggest motivators of all human behavior and all advertising, and all, it's one of the hunger and sex are the things that drive us the most, it seems. And you have no practice of that one, the one that's going to drive, that drives you and has driven all of selection and evolution. Deny that until it's time to completely handle it professionally as a grown adult that's married. I mean, professional is not the right word, but that's an absurd thought.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd, and it's setting up for a lot of pain. It also sets up early marriage, right? Like, we know, statistically speaking, that young people who grew up in purity culture aren't more likely to abstain, but they are more likely to get married really early and have miserable marriages.
That's
because
right.
They got married in order to be able to have sex and not because this is somebody that they actually thought would be a good life partner.
Yeah, but Jacqueline, I know somebody that got married at 19 and they're happily married to this day. So that what you said must be invalid. Right?
No, I mean, look, there's an exception to everything. I'm happy for them. But statistically speaking, in the aggregate, it's not a good formula for happiness, right? Like, there's you can find an exception to every rule. But on the average, young people who get married because they think that's the only way to legitimately have sex have unhappy...
It causes a lot of marriages is the point.
Yeah. Exactly. And not for the reasons you'd want someone to be getting married.
Yeah, I've been struggling with trying to rethink this stuff because it was laid down pretty well, I mean, for me. And now I'm thinking about through the frame of my kids, my daughters, and all that stuff.
Right.
And I saw a tweet yesterday that was like, somebody asked, well, what is purity culture? And the guy responded, he said, okay, pretty much, it was somebody foreign or something that didn't know, like just wasn't sure what the evangelical term or whatever the purity culture was. And he said, okay, I'll explain it like this. At a youth group event when I was 16, they took the youth pastor took out a cup and passed it around the room and had everybody spit in the cup. And then when they got the cup done, everybody spit in it. He asked, who wants to drink this? Everybody says no. And that says, and that's what you are if you have sex with a bunch of people. That's like, that's nobody would want to have sex with, you know, nobody will want you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is
you're that. And it's focused on the female and all that stuff, just like you said.
Treating women as a commodity, right? Like,
exactly.
That you want a trophy, you want the extra virgin oil pressing, right? Like,
that's right.
You know, like the idea that, like, if I have sex, then I'm not maybe going to be better at it because I've had practice, right? Like that I'm going to be inherently devalued because I have experienced something is, I mean, honestly, just deeply offensive and wrong.
Mm-hmm. And it builds up the thing I realized is like when I got married, I was thinking the only words I can think of is like the finish line. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't actually have sex with anybody else but her. And, you know, so I did it in a way, even though I'd had oral sex a bunch of times, I'd done, you know, everything but vaginal sex, basically. I thought on somehow I was maintaining some relationship with my God, and somehow I was respecting the women I was dating by just only me performing or her performing oral sex. Like the whole thing was
mutual about it.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that but also.
Oh, Toby's great with the mutuality of the oral. Yeah. I mean, never been a problem.
But that's what's interesting is like there. I mean, it set up a weird. Idea of what sex would be too, like, oh wait, you can do this stuff, but you can't do this stuff and then all of a sudden you're married and you can do anything maybe, but you don't even know.
You thought you were going to get a reward for waiting.
Yeah. I thought, oh man,
thought
wait
you deserve
till my honeymoon
for
will have sex.
Efforts,
unbelievable. Yeah. And all of that. And I think there, like maybe we should even define too, like there are good reasons not to have sex, right?
There are a ton of good reasons not to have sex, but everyone gets to define them for themselves. Right.
Right. But how do you frame that with a 12-year-old and they're
horny
starting, 15 or 9
year old.
Or 15 year old? Like when we're talking about education, how do you say Do you tell them everything's on the table, but be careful? Like, that's what I'm getting at. Like, and I'm headed there now, getting ready to have some conversations, and I feel like I'm already behind the eight ball a little bit.
How old are your kids? Probably already talked.
But my oldest is 9, then I got 7 and a 6-year-old.
Here's how I think about this. I think about it in terms of the individual kid's readiness. And I think we talked last time I was on, there's a wonderful website for young people around sex, which is called scarletteen.com. So like the word scarlet with E-E-N at the end. And they have on their site something called a sex readiness checklist, which goes over all the things you want to think about before you decide to have partnered sex. So it's obviously different than masturbation, which is a different kind of sex. But some of those things are, do I feel like I can talk about safer sex, right? Am I ready to, does that feel super awkward to say, how are we going to be protective of each other? Do I feel ready to negotiate and pay attention to my partner around consent? Do I feel like if I have sex with this person and then they don't want to talk to me anymore, like, how am I going to take that? Am I emotionally ready to take that kind of rejection? So there's like an emotional maturity question around a lot of the responsibilities that come with being sexual with another person. And the question is this individual person? And it's not just young people. We talk about it for young people, but all of us at different points in our lives are not ready to show up for other people like that when we've got other stuff going on mentally for ourselves. Like,
That is just ridiculous how obviously simple that is. If you just take it out of the realm of sex, and I never really put two and two together like that, but it'd be maybe similar to horror movie watching or ready to swim in the deep end or whatever. There's a thing I do with my kids where, like, if my daughter climbs a tree and she wants to get into some situation, she says, help me get down from here or help me get up here. I will say, no. I say, if you can't get out of the situation, I'm not going to help you. Like, You need to decide how far you can go up a tree and still get down. You don't need to get in a situation you can't handle. Same with the horror movies. It's like some kids are going to be able to handle it. You can take a custom approach to it. Can they articulate that it's real or not real? Do they really understand? And that's a maturity thing. So with sex, if you're a horny 15-year-old boy and you can do nothing but giggle when somebody talks about sex or safe sex, you probably shouldn't be also having it.
Right.
Like, yeah, of course you could have sex, but you don't have any of the tools and you can't even have a healthy adult conversation about it. So maybe that's the barrier to why this isn't, you know.
Exactly.
On the other hand, the message you said is something along the lines of, well, you define it for yourself. I don't know how you tell a 15-year-old horny boy. Yeah, you just define it for yourself. What do you do?
Well, that's why I really recommend this sex readiness checklist, because it gives you a structure to talk through these questions with a young person or anybody else, honestly. But it also, if they're not going to talk about it with you, you can also say, like, I want you to make sure you're ready according to this checklist, right? It's not just you decide, good luck, right? You can give them a framework about thinking about whether they're ready. But the framework isn't literally what is your age and marital status, because that doesn't really tell you anything about anyone's sexual maturity.
But I haven't looked at that checklist, but does it include, like, to actually be able to discuss it, like, with your parents, or is it private? Like, if you're a 16-year-old and you feel like you're ready on the checklist, do you need to talk to your parents about it?
Ooh, I don't know if that's on the checklist or not. I'm going to look it up, but I feel complicated about that because not everybody's parents are the same, right? So
right.
I wouldn't want to blanket say, if you're not ready to talk about this with your parents, you shouldn't have sex. If you have parents who think you're literally going to go to hell if you have sex.
Yeah.
Or if you're a queer kid and you want to have sex with somebody of the same gender and you literally, like, it's unsafe for you to talk to your parents about that. So I think that is a more relationship by relationship thing, which is bringing up something that I think underlies a lot of this stuff, which is that people really crave these black and white binary rules. Mm-hmm. Right, which is, I think, why the purity culture appeals in some ways. Like, it says, here's what's right and here's what's wrong. Nobody has to think about it.
Right.
And in some ways, that's comforting, right? Like, oh, somebody made this decision. Life is complicated enough. Here is a clean answer.
But God gave the answer. How clean could it get?
Exactly.
Easy. It wasn't the experts. It's better than that. So we're pretty sure about this one is the way it feels, you know.
But in reality, sex is a human interaction, and it's messy and complicated and contextual like every other human interaction.
No doubt about it. But, you know, the fear is really what drives it. So what do you think about, you know, like, what is the deal with the interconnection here of like the public school, like Toby said, oh, even in public school, that's not a Christian or evangelical thing, but there's a whole lot of real lockstep with religious culture and federal or state. I don't know who controls sex ed, but they're, I mean, same when they do evolution in schools and intelligent design, it's like,
right,
they're not really separate entities. They're both outflows of the same
they should be they should
thing
by design of our country they should be but they
should
are
be.
Not.
Yep. Not
and that's for a whole bunch of reasons. You said you don't know who controls the sex ed in schools, and the answer is
I don't actually
nobody. So the federal government makes no regulations basically about sex ed in schools. Some states have laws on the books about it, and some states have no laws, and literally it goes school district by school district and sometimes classroom by classroom. And there's just an absolute morass. So, for example, there's something like, I mean, I may be getting these numbers slightly wrong. There's something like 9 states that mandate that sex ed has to talk about LGBT students. But 4 of those states mandate that you can only say bad things about them. Right, you have to talk about LGBT students, and you have to say they're wrong and bad.
4 states?
Yeah. I don't know what they are off the top of my head.
Washington.
Yeah. Yeah, California, Oregon, Washington, and New York.
You got it. You nailed it, guys. So it's a total morass, and there's no way of knowing what's happening in your area unless you look into it and ask. But also, you don't want to make a, you know, you made jokes about blue states, but I live in Massachusetts, which everyone thinks of as a blue state, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our House and our Senate at the state level are run by Democrats. And we have not been able to pass a bill that we're on the 5th attempt, the 9th year of trying, that literally just says, if you teach sex ed in public schools, it has to be based in science and it has to be LGBTQ affirming and talk about consent. Basically, it can't just be religious propaganda. And it doesn't even mandate that you have to teach sex ed. It just says, if you do, you can't teach religious propaganda that has no basis in fact. Yeah. And we can't get it passed even here in Massachusetts because
those things are hard to define, I guess, for some people, you know, like what is propaganda and religious and what's true. And that stuff just gets, it's just so complicated.
I don't think science is that hard to define.
All right, before we go any further, I'm going to drop a kick-ass song on you guys. And the song is called A Voice in the Violence. And it's a single from a band that I believe you should like. It's Wolves at the Gate. They've got a new record called Eclipse coming out. Or it is out. The album just came out this week, as in a couple days ago. And it's time to start paying attention to it if you haven't saved it or gone there on Spotify. They haven't had an album come out since 2016. So this is kind of big time. So let's check out the song a little bit more. Okay, again, this is A Voice in the Violence, a single from Wolves at the Gate for their new record, Eclipse. This is their 4th full-length record with Solid State Records, and it's the first one since 2016. Pre-orders are still available, even though the album is out, if you like to get other things. And, of course, that supports the artist and Tooth and Nail and everything else. Wolvesatthegate.merchnow.com. They've got several different bundles to choose from over there. Follow the band's pages on Spotify and Apple Music so you can get alerts when new music comes out and whatever else is going on. So Eclipse is out now. Go dig it. I mean, you would want to say, I understand that is how people, it seems that way, but it's just, I mean, you could, you know, it's just not that clear. I mean, I wish it was, and I feel that it is, personally. It's just people don't agree about what's real or true or where truth comes from. They're so suspicious of science. They just don't,
but
they
like,
feel,
for
I don't
example,
know.
Teaching that condoms are ineffective as birth control is just factually false. It's false, but it's in a lot of abstinence-only propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
So it's literally not that complicated.
But no, yeah, but that part's not complicated. But to get people to agree about it is that's the. So here's kind of why I'm interested in doing this conversation is because this is where I get really lost, because as soon as it becomes political, so let's jump out of this and talk about, I don't know, firearms. That isn't an honest conversation, and that's why I don't fuck around with politics at all, because it's not real, and nobody's telling the truth, and nobody's acting in good faith, and I just can't operate in that space.
I don't think you mean nobody. Do you mean nobody?
Well, it's getting worse, but I mean, for instance, on the Second Amendment stuff, is the Second Amendment the one with the firearms? I think so. It's don't give an inch, and even if there's an idea that you don't actually hold that would help move the center line of the two polar sides, then you have to. It's that mentality. It's not about, are we having a conversation? Can we agree? It's, I'm trying to move. It's like it's a hostile negotiation of trying to move the anchor point of the center by extreme tactics that are either dishonest or disingenuous, or at least not in good faith.
I mean, I think you can find people on both sides who are doing that, but you can also find people who are trying to have a conversation. I don't think that
they're usually not effective in politics, though. Like, if I go to try to talk politics, it'll just be like, huh, I see where you're coming. I mean, everybody's just going to listen to the loudmouth pushing the, you know, to engage there effectively, you have to be pushing. Like, it just seems so agenda-based. It seems pointless to
I mean, I think it's really funny talking. That you think you're not engaging in politics right now.
Well, you know, I do think that my words and my conversations matter, but politically, I don't want them to be political. I do not want what I do to get to the realm of politics. I want it to stay in the realm of social, human, influential interactions.
You don't know what you mean by politics, then.
Okay. Well, then we have a good spot to talk here. I mean by politics that when something goes from being like, think of a political issue that's reasonable to engage, in my opinion, is an economic issue or a political. Politics should be boring, in my opinion. That politics should just be pretty boring, and some people pay attention to it because it's the level of policy and voting, and very few people really understand unintended consequence and any of that kind
of
stuff.
But here I am talking about policy. We're trying to get a policy mm-hmm. passed here in Massachusetts that says that you have to be able to back up your sex ed curriculum mm-hmm. with, you know, peer-reviewed, credible research. And mm-hmm. you're saying nobody can agree on facts, right?
I'm saying that information is extremely important, and that conversation is extremely important. And I want to go to as many people as possible, but I don't want any of those people to be thinking about politics while they're having that conversation.
But what do you mean by politics? All of this is politics.
Voting, policy, government. I don't want to. I think the most powerful and important influence is the other way around. I think it comes from art. I think it comes from social. I think it comes from interaction. And culture. Those
right,
are the things that I'm interested
in. But if people don't translate the shifts that they experience from all that cultural stuff into voting, into calling their legislators and saying, hey, I need you to pass this policy, then we don't get any change happening.
Well, people that are interested in politics and like voting and writing their congressmen can and should do that. But changing the culture upstream is just, I'm just saying more of my interest, not to get a vote passed or whatever. I would like to make even more fundamental cultural changes. I'm not really diminishing that some people should be involved in politics. I just wish less people were. Like, at the real level, it should
be
like...
You want fewer people to be voting?
I want less people to be reacting with their amygdala and voting. Yes, I do.
You want more people who agree with you to be voting?
No, I don't vote. I'm not interested, is what I'm saying. I'm not interested in that world. I am interested in changing people's opinions. I'm interested in sharing information. I'm interested in people arriving at their conclusions with the best information. And do at the political level, above a firearms debate or an abortion debate, I don't think anybody changes their mind. I think they harden their worst stances if they engage at that level. I'm not going to participate in that type of thing. I want to learn from you. I want to change my view over time.
I want to change your view about what politics is and whether you should vote.
Okay. Well, I'm open to it. Go for it.
So one of the ways we create a culture together, the ways we create a society together, is to agree on what the rules should be. And politics is the process by which we do that. You're obviously very interested in and smart about how the culture should be. You're very interested in that. And so you're missing out on a really important opportunity to shape that by opting out of the political process.
I think one thing Matt's not saying too is that I don't think that he thinks the political process is trustworthy, and it might seem as if it is, but then it is. For example, how about like the Me Too movement? I believe just the idea of the Me Too movement awakened an entire culture, maybe a country, not enough change or anything, but more than the government could have done. Now, public perception of people breaking the rules, doing horrific things. Now, I think now you're seeing the culture and the people change each other's minds, as opposed to a law that said there can't be a casting couch. I'm thinking the bigger terms of like our culture actually, and it maybe actually does move people, and then the government responds to it more than the government does something and we respond to it.
Yeah, those politicians will pander to whatever the culture decides.
The idea that the government is separate from you is the one that I want to disabuse you of. Right.
So, well, no, I'm just saying, but the politicians will pander to and get votes out of whatever will help them. But once the culture just decides what it cares about,
if you won't vote, then the politicians are not going to do what you want. If you opt out of voting, the politicians don't care about you.
I'm not clear on what I want.
Giving away your power. So, for example, Me Too actually is changing the rules. So on the House and Senate, on the federal level, they're changing the rules about the way that sexual harassment claims are handled inside the government. Absolutely, Me Too is changing the laws, but only because people who've been awoken by Me Too are voting and are making themselves understood. And so if you have values and you're not expressing them, you're leaving that to other people to do work for you.
Yes and no. I mean, I trust the process in a way. I'm not like.
But you just told me the opposite thing, which is that you don't trust the process at all, which is why you don't.
Well, I don't for sure.
Well, no. What I'm saying is I trust the process in a general way, that the outcome of politics will simply be the convergence of where political pandering meets public perception or something like that. Like, it's neither here nor there. It'll just go the way it goes. But how do we get it to where the votes will go the good way? But my vote, I don't give a shit about. My hashtags will be much, a good hashtag's better than a good vote. More effective.
I couldn't disagree with you more, especially on the local level, right? On the state and local level, a vote makes an enormous difference. So it may feel infinitesimal in terms of the federal government, but what states do you live in?
Well, I think that's a good idea. I think you're right about that, as it would pertain to my property tax here in my county. Yes, I agree.
Right, but also your really school board and what they're teaching.
National outrage.
No, we're talking about sex ed. And sex ed is decided on the school board level in most places. Do you know how few people vote on
school
board? Yeah,
that's great. No, go to the school board. Do that.
You should vote
that's
for
fine. Maybe
on the school board.
I agree. Yeah, I'm not saying that. I agree that as you get closer to locality, it's much more. Your vote is what's more important.
So do you vote in your local elections?
No. I've never voted on anything in my life, to
be
honest.
You're throwing away. I mean, you care about this stuff. You're having me on to talk to me for an hour, right? Mm-hmm. So
I hope it really changes culture too. And the votes land. I hope the votes go according, but I'm not too worried about my one, is what I'm telling you. Being removed from the I don't have an agenda, I assure you. I'm just trying to get to the truth. I hate those parties. I hate those politicians. I would not support them. I don't like it. It, the system is beyond what I, it's corrupt at a level that I'm
like
uncomfortable with.
Democrats or Republicans, it's the to best vote we've got for a candidate for your school board that's going to support good sex ed in your schools.
Well, yeah, but I don't know what that candidate thinks about the every other issue either. And it's
it's not that hard to find out. It really,
no, I know. But what I'm saying is they all support stuff that I think is horrific, and I won't support them directly.
But
I'm not doing
know that they do on the local level. I don't think you know that either.
Well, I'm in Seattle, and I do pay attention to it. I do read about it. I just don't. It's like, to me, I'm coming from an angle where my conscience, like, I want to speak about it, and I don't want to have a team, and I'm not going to have a team, and I won't support those people. I think they are tribal and team-like, and I feel wrong participating with that. I do want to influence people. I do want to find the truth, and I feel wrong checking this box or that box, even if I'm in total alignment with a special cause issue like sex ed. Maybe I am, but the people that support what I want on sex ed have so many other ideas that I find horrific and pandery, especially where I am in Seattle and the politics here. It's like, I wash my hands of it in a way. I'm going to find another way for me to contribute is the way that I feel about that. And I think the system is kind of fucked up, and I also think it's the best we've got, and I do support our country and our government, our constitution, and everything. I mean, I trust it. I wish it was a lot better, but I'm going to spend my time and effort in the other area.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Is that doesn't seem right, reasonable to you?
I don't think voting takes that much time and effort. I don't think that's an either or proposition.
Well, I understand.
I totally agree with you that I don't think our government is super great and that our system is broken, basically. Although sometimes I say our system is broken and I think, or it's functioning exactly as it was designed by like wealthy white guys who owned other people, like you know, maybe our system is functioning as intended, which is bad. But I don't think that we can change it without participating.
Well, I think like what we're saying here, we're probably saying the same thing. I think you put more value, and I think you make a great point on the local level. I do think your vote matters more. But for example, we grew up in South Carolina. Everything was red no matter what. So it didn't matter who voted what way, it was going to be red, which the most surprising thing is when I moved to Seattle in 2001, it was just no matter what, everything was going to be blue. Like it was almost like the exact same fundamentalist attitude just from coming from different points. And I felt like my vote never really mattered in those areas just because no one was really going to change. Now, what I do think is changes culture and everything is having conversations with people who are different minded about certain things. Like I think us and you having this conversation, I'm sure there's a billion things we disagree on, but we're having a great conversation that's challenging. Last time you came on, in fact, challenged me more than probably you'll ever realize just about sexuality and what that can mean, especially for my kids. Just like what I would think of now of my kids having sex as opposed to before our conversation, I've really made some big changes. And so that feels like the real thing. That feels like the thing where, oh, okay, now just in my home is changing. And then I might influence somebody and that person might. And so then you have some real influence there. Then I think you're actually using your voice in a more effective way. And you're probably saying, and in both.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would do whatever I could to ever keep anybody from calling me a Republican or a Democrat. I would be so upset if somebody framed me as one or the other of that. I would be so devastated. I wouldn't. It's not worth it to me to ever get near that. It's the way I feel.
Yeah. I am also a registered independent.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, sure, I could be independent. I know, but I mean, whatever. I vote for the third party. It won't matter. It just doesn't. I mean, I'm just interested in other things is the way I would say it. But what I'm curious about, if it's fine to move past that, if you think
I mean, look, I don't think that going around this is going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I do respect people that are active in politics also. And so I don't mean everybody should do what I do. So don't hear me say nobody should vote. I think, I hope, and I trust that people are politically active that care and are smart and pay attention and read way more than I do. I hope that, and I trust that, and I do believe that. I'm counting on you and other people to do that in a way. And so right. You can say that's me wanting other people to do work or whatever. But the point is, I do support political work. And then that political stuff now also, it becomes, blurs into activism. So now I think this is a whole interesting territory. And I'm curious of more of the other, like you said, you're handling stuff politically. I'm very interested in the stuff you're doing at immigration. You got arrested. I mean, I want to talk about that. Like, I'm not against your involvement. And I mean, I'm curious about that. Yeah. I was just highlighting that I have a different approach and angle. And I want to hear more about yours, but I want to hear about you get arrested.
Yeah. That's, everyone wants to talk to me about that right now, which is fine with me. Yeah, I got arrested with 17 other Jews in Boston protesting ICE's ongoing detention of immigrants coming across the southern border. It was part of a movement of Jews who've been having protests like this around the country. Last week, time is a flat circle. Very recently, they had a huge action in D.C. where they actually secured the perimeter of the ICE building in D.C. for 5 hours and wouldn't let anyone in and out. ICE had to go on lockdown, which was pretty badass. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did it because I am a Jew and because I see very clearly that the U.S. government is running concentration camps at the southern border. I do not know how you guys feel about my saying that, but it seems plain as the nose on my face to me.
Let's actually stop there. I just asked you questions. What are you worried that I might think different about that? What would be the,
I don't know.
What gives you pause there?
People get very worked up when you say the word concentration camp. People yell at me about it all the time. So I just wanted to stop and give you all a chance to let me know where you're at on this issue.
Well, it should be pretty easy, though. What's your definition of concentration camps? And what do you intend to convey by using that word?
Concentration camps have a historical definition. And they actually had one before the Holocaust, right? So it's when a population of people, usually with a racial definition or an ethnic definition, are being detained indefinitely in ways that have nothing to do with the criminal justice system and are detained in inhumane conditions en masse. And that is literally what is happening.
So my opinion then would be a really, really nuanced one, I guess, and then some real weird middle state. But I agree with that. I'm pretty sure I agree with that. However, it seems that the use of that term is intended to evoke death camp, to make the thing seem more scary, because it, you know, and correct me here, but you don't think that the goal is to concentrate more people and then exterminate them, though.
Goal when Hitler started concentrating the Jews into camps either. I think it can get there if we don't stop it now. I don't think that is presently the intention, but I don't want to get to a place where it is. It needs to stop now before we get to that place.
I think I can almost even understand that. So, but then I'm back into Hitler's psychology now. Do you think Hitler knew that he wanted to kill Jews, and like Trump wants to kill Mexicans, though? Like, that seems not the most precise.
If you look at contemporaneous coverage of Hitler in the early days of his political rise, there's all this coverage of him that says, oh, don't worry, he's just using anti-Semitism to rile up his base. He's not really invested in it. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I did not know the man. Right? Like, I don't know at what point he decided he wanted to mass exterminate Jews. And it's entirely possible that he started just thinking they were a useful scapegoat. You know, we see this play happen over and over again in the rise of authoritarian leaders, however you want to describe it, that they have to pick relatively powerless enemy to get everybody to hate so that they don't notice that the authoritarian is actually taking all the power. And, you know, Hitler picked the Jews, and Trump has clearly picked Latinx, brown people. You know, and it's literally the same playbook. We are earlier in the playbook than what we know of how the Holocaust ended, but that doesn't mean that horrific creeping authoritarianism isn't happening now, and we shouldn't stop it now, right? Like, I really wish for my Jewish ancestors that more people in Weimar Germany had like stopped partying for a minute and protested early on and not waited and said, oh, how could we have known? They weren't too bad in the beginning. They made the economy work and the trains run on time. Well, it wasn't any of my business. You know, I've seen this play before and I feel it in my bones.
You've seen this play. Okay, I'm going to defend your point of view one a little bit farther, and then I'm going to ask another question that I'm unclear on the answer. You are very right about that. That, like, if that's your, that's, I understand that is your genuine point of view, that there is, and I'm going to try and make it numerical. It sounds to me like you're saying, hey, I'm not saying that the plan here is to exterminate brown people. What I'm saying is it could be that, or it could turn into that. And even if I think there's a 90% chance that that's not true, I wish people, I mean, if a 10% chance of genocide is exceedingly high,
it's, you know, terrible. 1% chance. Yes, it's really,
so we want to
really
just at
bad.
Least.
And also, it doesn't have to be genocide to be horrible, right? Like,
of course,
mass atrocities being committed against children by our government, paid for with our tax dollars, and whether or not they lead to genocide, we have to fucking stop them.
Yes.
You can call it concentration camps or not. That is what I see. I don't really want to argue about the words. I'm not saying you are, but I hear it from a lot of people. No, I don't. For sure. I honestly, like, if you're more interested, and I'm talking about the hypothetical you, not you too, about arguing with me about the phrase concentration camp and not the mass atrocities that are being committed against children in cages right now, paid for by our tax dollars, then you have a lot of things to work out with yourself ethically.
Yes. Now, I think that all the things that you're saying are completely unacceptable and are a problem, and they're a problem no matter what administration or who, anything like that. The whole thing is super fucked up. I mean, when you look at the chill, I mean, that's true. So what I agree, any way to raise awareness of or do it different or any possibility, because if there's anything about Trump, it's he's clearly authoritarian in nature. He's clearly doesn't care about what happens to other people. It may. Worse atrocities are possible if they became expedient to him. I believe
exactly.
That.
Exactly. If
that's
it's expedient,
easy to understand.
He will do literally whatever.
Yeah. And I agree that he has no character and he's a bad person. And so whatever. But I don't think he's, has some master plan to do stuff like that. The question is, though, if we agree about that, is it, what do you think about the line of thinking that's saying that our overreach or over exaggeration of what he is like saying that he's going to go kill everybody and this is concentration camps and we'll be extermination? Like, what about the line of thinking that says that's so aggressive in a sense that that is going to hurt the Democrats and it's going to hurt,
but
it's going to get Trump reelected?
Who
is that
is
not
saying that he's going to exterminate everyone?
I think the choice of extreme language, again, as we're talking about guns or sex or even this, I'm worried that that's going to help Trump and backfire is all I'm saying. Strategically, I disagree. I don't think
concentration camps is extreme language. It is literally the correct term for what is happening at the border.
Right. But all the MAGA people think that you're saying extermination camps. And so they react to that.
The MAGA people will think I'm saying extremist things if I say it is partly cloudy today.
Mm-hmm.
I am not trying to reach them.
You don't think left overreach is a danger to getting Trump reelected?
I think left passivity is a danger to getting Trump reelected.
Mm. Tell me more about that. That's interesting.
I think that there are an enormous amount of people who didn't vote and who don't vote, like you. And I think who are decent people who see that things are bad and that those are the people I want to convince to come out. Like converting somebody who mainlines Fox News all day, every day is not something I'm going to be effective at. That's just not, it's not a priority of mine. There are way more people who are actually movable to vote.
Right. But the best way to get them to vote is fear and outrage. And now the left is going to use that. That doesn't seem right to me. Like,
no.
Like you can get more people to vote if you make them scared and you make them outraged. So if you want more people to vote, that should be the plan.
I'm never going to use fear. I just morally opposed to it.
You don't think that using concentration camps that you know conjures extermination is leaning into causing fear, though?
I'm not, I mean, what I'm afraid is that the status quo will continue.
Yeah.
So I'm expressing how I feel, right? Like I'm telling you that I am outraged. I am heartsick. I will not stand for this being done in my name and with my tax dollars. What mm-hmm. I'm very invested in is building community, actually, and acting mm-hmm. from a place of love and solidarity. Like, you know, there was a report out today that ICE was supposed to do a roundup of 2,000 immigrants that they had identified for a mass roundup that Trump's been touting, and they've been able to bring in 35. And they say that the reason is because the communities are rallying around their migrant neighbors. And that's what I'm for, which is love and solidarity, which is actually the power we have in the face of division and fear. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm hoping is I will inspire other people to stand up together about community and standing up for people who we may be being taught to fear, and to actually mm-hmm. to overcome that fear of the brown other coming over the border yeah. and actually show love and solidarity to them and imagine that they are you. Imagine that that is your child.
Yep. Yes.
I think that's what I think, Matt, maybe this is what you're getting at too. I think the subtlety or the simplicity maybe is the better word of Trump's dialogue about things is what actually makes him effective, which is really scary. And it makes me feel bad about America. For example, Trump slides in, hey, we're trying to do is stop the bad hombres, I think was the way he termed it, right? Bad hombres is his term. And then that infiltrates into culture, the idea or the thoughts, especially on the right side, maybe mostly majority on the right side. Oh, well, we're just trying to keep out bad people that are going to hurt us. I want to protect everybody. And the common person goes, I'm working 40 hours a week. I'm doing all I can. And then you're telling me that somebody's coming into the country illegally, not the right way, and this, and they just buy into this narrative that, oh, wait a minute, everybody's bad. Oh,
shallow political.
You're
going
to make
engagement.
Me feel bad because of kids, but I didn't ask them to come here, and you're blaming me, and so.
And meanwhile, the reason that person may be actually economically insecure is because Trump passed a tax cut that favors billionaires and his billionaire buddies and takes money out of the pockets of the working poor. You know, like, and he's cutting food stamps, right? It's a classic distraction mechanism, which is say,
for sure,
those people over there are the ones you should fear. I'm helping you. When in fact, the reverse is true. But I want to talk about illegal for a second.
Okay.
So I want to be super clear. Obviously, the children have done nothing wrong, right?
Right, right.
And they're also being detained in truly abusive conditions.
Agree.
But put them aside for a second, if we can, and say that applying for asylum is not illegal. Applying for asylum is perfectly legal. And many mm-hmm. of these people have come here seeking asylum from horrific conditions. But let's put those aside for a second and talk about the people who have truly crossed the border illegally. Okay? Crossing the border illegally is a misdemeanor. It's a federal misdemeanor. It is literally in the same class of federal misdemeanor as running a stop sign at the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. You're telling me that they deserve whatever they get because they broke the law. Then you're also telling me that if you're driving with your child at the Pentagon and you run a stop sign, that the government has the right to take you and that child, separate you, and throw you in separate concentration camps indefinitely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Possibly give your child to foster parents. You know, so the idea that that they broke a law, it sounds like they're like terrifying criminals, but it's literally like the same as running a stop sign, the law that they're breaking.
Well, I was going to say, I think the issue too, though, and this is what goes back to which makes me not trust the government, is there aren't good answers being given. It's just like, it feels like it's more like hate each other. Like for example, if somebody hears that, what you just said, I could understand. For example, I'm from the South and my dad hears you say running a stop sign, you would split up a mom and a kid. He would go, but I'm here legally and I might have broke the law, but you're not defending me. You would be defending somebody from another country that you don't know. What you're saying is you care about people and children and families, and what they're doing isn't as crazy as Trump is making it sound, which I understand as well. But the problem I feel with all of this is the language and the lingo and the terminology we're using is meant to be divisive. The government loves it and it keeps us engaged in this stuff, which I think is the big distraction. I don't know. Like, I feel like you're putting your money where your mouth is and you are literally putting your own life in jeopardy or your own freedom in jeopardy, which I think is super honorable and respectful. And I know a lot of people wouldn't do that. Maybe even including myself. I would
be
very
scared. Yeah, that's activism, not political. Yeah, I'd be beyond very scared.
It was no joke. As a survivor of sexual violence, to like give up my bottle, basically autonomy to like men with
guns.
I can't imagine. It was a lot, but like that's what we need to do for each other. That's radical love for me.
Yeah, I know. I agree. That's what I'm saying. How do I convince my dad what you're saying is right? Because it is. You're right. Even as a Christian or a person, you cannot, like my dad thinks, oh, wait a minute. If you let everybody in, there'll be a terrorist and something like 9/11 will happen because the fear tactics have been used. But my dad isn't a bad guy. He just, like Matt said, the scary stuff works.
It makes
the
my dad go, oh,
really
wait.
It's working. Yeah. And look, yeah. I don't have all the answers. Like if I knew the answer to that, I'd be running a political consulting company or something. But here's what I think. Part of it, I actually think that you have a power I don't have, which is that you're familiar with the Bible in a way that I'm not, especially the New Testament, right? But it seems to me, I'm a Jew, what do I know? But it seems to me that Jesus would have done what I did at the very
least. Oh,
yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
100%.
So I don't know. Well, the thing that I don't understand is how your dad can love Jesus and think of himself as a follower of Jesus and hate immigrants, because Jesus is very clear on this matter.
I think it's kind of easy to understand how, and I don't mean that to disagree with you. I'm just looking at it from a different point of view. I think it's a real curiosity for me as an outsider. See if this answer rings true then.
Yeah.
He has an extremely cartoon, ridiculous view of immigrants and all that he actually possesses because it was instilled in him fearfully and he's internalized it and doesn't even know, but that he possesses a very cartoon understanding of that. I also believe it possesses a ridiculously cartoon understanding of who Jesus is. So it's just it's just incredible immaturity, because or any average person is not an activist or a deep scholar or somebody that focuses. That's all they get. They just get manipulated by the government, the culture, the social media, the outrage, the political party, their local church. They just get the reduced bullshit. It's the opposite of taking a kid, teaching them about sex, seeing if they're ready, getting them, like that whole thing where you customize to a person. Well, we don't do that. We're just overrun by fear, domination, structures. You're evangelical. You're Democrat. You're on the board. He's a working guy. He doesn't have time to know if his fears are legitimate. He's just scared. And he's been told Jesus is good and that's bad. And that's about all he had time for. And it's like a 9-year-old, maybe.
Yeah, as far as he can go with as far as he could probably even go is, wait a minute, you were blocking my way on the way to work. I got to be at work at 7 a.m. You don't care about me. You're just trying to stop me from working. I'm just trying to keep my head above water or something like that. Now, if you could inform him, if he could see what you're doing, if he could go to the border, see the children, see the families, he'd probably be brought to tears. I believe that. I know my dad well enough. But that's what I'm saying. It's so effective, the simplicity of Trump's message. And this feels so sick to say. It's almost welcoming as safety. Wait a minute. We're not trying to hurt kids and families. We don't come here. I'm trying to protect all of America, red, blue, whatever. And that's Trump's underlying message. And it's so effective. And it's really scary because what we end up missing is everything that actually is real and not cartoonish. What you're saying isn't cartoonish. It's real. It's horrific. It's sad. And I do think the most effective thing, how can we get real answers? Like, I don't know if either side really can. Like the Democrats, it seems like, want to hate Trump and he's terrible at the border. The Republicans go, yeah, we got to have border safety. And nobody's really saying anything that's going to make it better. I mean, we have really, really bad situation. And right now, what do you think the answer is? The government says, okay, we'll give those families better housing. Like, I mean, like it's so complicated. Like if government changed something right now, just the border problem alone, do you have any effective ideas of like what would improve?
I mean,
I know that's a huge question.
I got so many things I want to say, some of which are the answer to that question and some of which I want to loop back around to actually talking about sex ed, which is relevant to this conversation, I promise.
I like it.
Yeah.
I think that we could go back to not criminalizing these people, right? The same way that we don't criminalize people who run a stop sign at the Pentagon, right? You issue a citation and you ask them to come to court and you don't hold them at all. And that was actually working for the long period of our history. And we see, statistically speaking, that immigrants are actually less likely to commit crimes than people who are, natural born U.S. citizens, right? So the idea that that's inviting crime is actually just not true. It's not factual. Right. We know that actually the vast majority of terrorism that's happened on U.S. soil in the last few years is white supremacist terrorism. So we have to look at realistically, we don't have to be holding these people. Holding these people is literally just torturing them.
Well, what should we do with, what would we do with them other than hold them though?
We issue them a citation if they've done something illegal. For the people who've come to apply for asylum, we process their asylum claims the way that they're supposed to be processed. And if someone has crossed the border illegally, we give them a citation and an order to appear in court to answer for it the same we would if we if you ran a stop sign at the Pentagon. That is right. What we should do. And we should also get real about the fact that the reason that all these people are fleeing is because their countries are in great chaos, and get real about actually trying to help these countries instead of force them to sign to do things that they're not capable of doing and sort of threaten them with tariffs if they don't toe the Trump line. So that's my answer to what we should be doing at the border in the very shortest amount of time. Obviously, it's a very complicated discussion, and I'm not an expert, but that's the very basic baseline. But I want to say a bigger thing.
But you know, if the question came about open borders, people act like all the Democrats want open borders, but they will say, no, that's not what we want. But again, is that what we need? Or where's the, like, yeah, we process them, we give them a citation, and then we send them back south. I mean, what do we do if they denied asylum? I mean, what do we do?
Yeah.
What do we do? You just turn those kids around and point them back to Honduras?
If we just not, yeah, I mean, we need better asylum laws. We certainly don't need Trump's asylum laws, but if they are not qualified to qualify for asylum. Look, we have to fit the immigration system overall it needs a giant overhaul. And I am not an immigration policy expert, so I can't help you with the big view of that. But at the very least, there's no reason for us to be detaining these people.
Right. So to me, that's activists need to work on human rights and atrocities with their full force. But the political discussion on what's a good border policy is a whole, just not even, that's a whole different thing.
I mean, I will say, and I know you hate the parties, but many of the Democrats who are currently running for president have very interesting and robust proposals for what immigration policy should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can find them on their websites and they talk about them in the press. It doesn't get covered very much, but there is an actual robust debate happening inside Democratic politics about what good immigration policy should be. And there's disagreement among people, among Democrats, about what good immigration policy should look like. So it's not like this is not being worked on. It's just not being covered because if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead, right?
No, of course. That's the problem.
Right. I think one of the things we haven't talked about here, we talked a lot about politicians, but we haven't talked a lot about journalism.
So, yeah, they're part and parcel to the problem. I think less bad than politicians.
I think there's a lot of great journalists out there, and I know a lot of them, but I think that overall, the media corporations that control what we see on the nightly news and, you know, on the front page of our local newspapers are making decisions based on what we'll sell, which they need to do to stay in business. And, you know, and then I'm going to descend into a capitalist critique, which we probably don't have time for. But I desperately want to come back around to talking about your dad. And I don't mean to put him on the spot, but I think that this is a really useful and instructive question. So I think that there are two answers. I want to answer it at two different levels.
Okay.
One is that one of the most powerful things you can do, because he is your dad, is try to have that complex conversation with him. And maybe you do. I'm not suggesting you don't. But, like, I think a lot of times we write the people in our families off because it's hard. It's so painful. And I want to validate that. It is hard and painful. And I have Trump voters in my family too. Like I just want to yell at them, like, you're a Jew. Like, what are you doing? But, but that's not helpful. Right. But that when there are people who we actually have influence with, like, asking them to engage with us, to at least hear us and not coming at them in accusatory ways, but actually trying to sort of get curious about where they're coming from and seeing if you can find points of agreement. Like, yeah, it is terrible that the economy is so unstable. I agree with you that you work harder than you should have to support yourself, or you should have been able to retire by now, or whatever it is, right, that they resent immigrants for. Like, that resentment is probably real. It's just the target is misplaced, right? And so starting from places of agreement and having those hard conversations is something that all of us can do with the people in our lives as a way of doing that culture change that you're talking about doing. But the bigger answer, which comes back to sex ed, is the desperate need for us to teach emotional literacy to the next generation, and especially the next generation of men.
I like that.
And that one of the things that a real comprehensive sex ed curriculum does is starts in early grades. And every time you talk about starting sex ed in early grades, someone will say you want to teach blowjobs to kindergartners. And that's not what I mean.
Right.
But talking about healthy touch and boundary setting and consent, but also accepting rejection, right? If you say, can I hug you? And that person says, I don't want you to, that you don't then shove that person, right? Like that, but learning emotional literacy and learning to say, just because I'm afraid doesn't mean someone should pay, right? Like, just because my feelings are hurt doesn't mean that person is bad. Like, you learning to engage our emotions and not fear and shut down our emotions actually could get us out of a lot of this mess and could get us around that fear. I think the people who are most vulnerable to the kind of fear mongering that you're talking about, that the Trump administration absolutely derives power from, are the kind of people who have not learned to interrogate their feelings, right? And have not learned to say,
that's right,
okay, I'm going to sit in this uncomfortable feeling and think about where it's coming from and what it actually means, and are just sort of operating on that instinctual level and never got emotional education. And that is actually one of the most powerful things that comes along with good sex ed that we keep refusing to teach in most of our public schools. There, I brought it all home.
That, and I love that too, because that's a whole nother box, but that's terrific, because it's a not an uncaring approach for men and masculinity who are going to face some difficulty in the coming times. It's very clear. So it's not just that they're bad. It's like, how can we help them to have the tools as they grow up healthier? Because it's obviously that's the need. They have needs more than just blame, I would say. I mean, certainly plenty of both to go around, but and I also think there's a point worth pointing out that if we got to engage in conversations with people like Toby's dad, who's a very normal person, by the way, that if we're going to get there, that means we have to understand that he probably actually has some other knowledge and intuitions and life experience that we probably don't get and need from him. Right.
Yeah.
But not on the kids in the cages. That one we hope to win him over. But we have to admit that those people must know something we don't know that's real also.
Well, that's why I'm saying you start by listening to what's at the root of the concern. So, like, what is the concern under the concern? So this is a thing I've been thinking about a lot lately. So this is going to set us off on a different tangent, and I don't know how long you want to go. But last year, 2 days after the final vote on the Kavanaugh confirmation, I was in Nebraska giving a talk in Lincoln at the university there. And it turned out, this was not planned, but it turned out that mostly the audience was dominated by a bunch of guys in several fraternities. I was expecting more of a mixed audience. That's what it turned out. That's fine. I talk to guys all the time about this stuff. As you know, I talk to you guys, right? But they got everyone, including me, was very riled up from the protracted Kavanaugh fight. And they couldn't stop talking about false rape allegations and their fear that someone was going to lie about them and ruin their life. Mm-hmm. And I was so raw and emotional at that point that I mostly just wanted to rip off my own head and throw it at them, right? I was not at my best. And I did my best and did all the sort of debunking I always do about factually how rare false rape allegations are, and actually most of them don't name it. I did all the sort of actual answers to their question, and it didn't help anybody, at least not in the moment, right? Nobody seemed convinced. And afterwards, I was thinking that I really should have answered the question under their question, right? The root question, which is, I feel vulnerable, right? I feel vulnerable. Yeah. And that's something we can all relate to, right? And if I had been able to relate to them on an emotional level and say, I see that you feel vulnerable, and I also feel vulnerable, and we feel vulnerable for different reasons that seem in opposition, but I bet we can find a way to make a bridge, right? Like that might have been a much more productive conversation. And I should just say in my own defense, I have more productive conversations with groups of men all the time, but that was not my finest hour.
You're terrific at this. You have a lot of ability to sit in tension, hold many things. That's very clear. Yeah. But we come from the world of evangelicalism, where you're supposed to evangelize and go convert people. And so we're very sensitive when we, you know, like from my view, it's like, okay, if you're going to engage in a conversation because you want to change somebody's opinion about anything, politics, God, anything, it is false unless you understand that you're willing to change too. If you like, I want to go change this person because I think he needs to know something different. There's no conversation unless I'm actually open to him changing me and coming out the conversation the other way or on a different matter. You know, that's what it takes. And politics and the contentious activist type things it's really hard to get that, but you're correct. If you can get to how we're both vulnerable, how we both have problems that we need to solve together, we have to be able to get there, but it can't be people showing up with answers to tell people facts.
Facts are so much less convincing than we ever think they are. I would like to live in a world where facts are convincing, but I don't live in that world. But so, like, if your dad may be leading with those immigrants are coming to make America less safe, you know, the question that I have is like, well, what is it that you feel what are your vulnerabilities? Like, what are the actual fears? Like, let's talk and sit with him about and make it clear that you take his fears seriously, even if you disagree with who he's blaming for them. And I think that's a really wonderful way of having these tough conversations.
Toby, you think he'll be down to the podcast next week and we can have that conversation?
Our podcast is the most liberal left-wing podcast he could ever imagine.
Does he listen? No, Lord, he
doesn't hardly know what a podcast is, but he thinks I am. I mean, he thinks probably Obama's conservative compared to me.
He thinks we're crazy, I'm sure.
Yeah, he thinks we're out there. And he's right in some instances, but in this, I think you're right. That is a really good point. Meeting somebody what is the real underlying thing there? I think you're right. Like my dad, there probably is underlying he would immediately, if you asked him about children and protecting them, he would say, yes, of course, families, breaking them apart. No way, you shouldn't do that. If you said certain things, but if you present it in one way, he would 100% agree with you. In the other way, he wouldn't. And the problem is that political line, that evangelical line, that Christian line, all of that just mucks it up and gets in the way of a real answer. Because, I mean, I've sat with him a bunch of times and talked to him. We've had some questions. I mean, we've had some serious knockdown. Okay. A huge knockdown drag out one is basically kind of about immigration, which would be the wall. And we had an hour long discussion, and I tried to stay calm and keep everything together and just say, listen, I understand. My point was, I was trying to say, I understand protecting the border, maybe every country in the world, or there should be some protections on the border. I'm 100% for that the right way, because if you're doing our border the right way, that means people are being better taken care of. That means bad guys don't get in, all of that stuff, everything. There should be a good, healthy way. I said, but I don't understand this wall thing. That doesn't make much sense. And he couldn't get past that because the wall was presented so strongly and so well by, if you will, the strongman character, which Trump plays up. He plays the strongman that's going to protect you. He knows about money. He knows about power. He knows about kicking ass. And that feels like America in a way. And that American dream, all that stuff's bad.
The brokest con man in the world.
Oh, 100%. But I mean, he is just a salesman in a way. I mean, yes. he can sell the brand thing really well, which is really disgusting. And that's what I'm hoping. I do wonder the political landscape of this next election, what it's going to look like. I mean, it's going to be almost, it will be the most watched thing ever, maybe.
I find that troubling.
It's already making me sick to my stomach, honestly.
I know, because
it's clear that Trump is going to get even more deeply authoritarian because he can't run this time around on empty promises of what he'll do when he's president, because we know that he didn't do any of those things, right? So he seems to be doubling down on the fear-mongering and the us versus them stuff so hard. And I don't know. I mean, like, look, you guys have said you're not that engaged in politics. I am very engaged in political conversations, and there are 100 opinions about the best way to beat him, and nobody actually knows the answer, right? Everybody has a different take. And one day I'm convinced by one thing, and one day I'm, you know, like, I don't know. But, and yet it is so high stakes, right?
Yeah, to me, the biggest danger, and this is, I'm not trying to defend my whole position, but just to color a little bit more, is that this whole thing sounds like it's, like Toby just said, it's going to be the most watched thing, and that is not a good thing, in my opinion. That is not good. That just means we're replacing college football with this, and we're bringing the same tribal energy of rivalry and hate. Like, I hate my rival football team. That's where that's healthy there.
I agree with you.
That's got a limit on it. If we take that into the mainstream thing, that's a disaster.
The journalists have some control over that, and they refuse to control it. Right? If you cover this election like a sports competition, which is what they do.
That's what I'm saying. That's what we're doing. That's negative to me.
But attention is not inherently negative. Like if the attention was about policy and impact, right? If the attention was about humans, you know.
Yeah, then the ratings would go back down to nerds that like policy, and that'd be fine with me. I don't want everybody. I don't want more of these people to vote. They don't know what they're talking about. They just want to get riled up and cheer for their team. I don't want them involved.
I think the horse race coverage is very damaging. It's very damaging.
I mean, that's what the media wants. Like you know how they make a lot of money on sports. Well, this pays better, and there's more people, and we can get, it's like the World Cup every day or whatever, you know, it's the Super Bowl every day. Of course we want people to act like sports fans about the politics. Good. Get everybody right. I mean, that's the thing I find damaging.
And the world's watching this time more than ever, too.
Yeah, and that's
the
not
rest of the. I mean,
good,
like, that's what I'm saying. I do think we need that. What I believe is we need another candidate that keeps things simple and says, "This is what I'm going to do." You know, like that. I think that is what it. Maybe that is what Trump's biggest strong point is. He goes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to build. He like just says wall over and over and over and over, you know, says or something. He just repeats stuff over and over, and it just gets stuck in the cultural lingo, even if it's comedy. I mean, Saturday Night Live loves that Trump is the president. It's the greatest ratings, best thing that's happened to them in probably decades or something like that. And so the problem is it is entertaining, but it's also our real life here. So we have to do something.
It's super real life. Like the rabbi's house in my town got lit on fire twice in a week last month.
Oh, Lord.
And I live, again, I can't stress enough, I live in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
It's super real life. And people are really losing sight of that. This is incitement to violence, what he's doing. I agree that what the Dems need, and none of us identify as Dems, but we acknowledge that if someone's going to beat Trump, it's going to be a Democrat, right?
Right.
And what the Dems need is someone who make people feel something emotionally and not just make people think. Because that's what Trump is good at, is galvanizing people emotionally. And so that's one of the things I'm looking for in a candidate to support in the primary is like, who makes people feel inspired? Who makes people come together? Who makes people want to show up and be our best selves? And not just who's like, I don't know, got off a good zinger on a debate stage, you know, like, and people are going to have different answers to that. Again, people in my life are just all arguing about this right now. Like, who should it be? And what's the right tactic? But this is, I think, why when you say, oh, if we say, you know, concentration camps or whatever the term is on the left, isn't that going to alienate Trump voters? Like, I actually think that someone galvanizing on the left is what we need.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe that as well. And the funniest thing, or not the funny, one of the most interesting things I ever could have imagined was we had 8 years of Obama, who was basically just, it was just so smooth. I mean, you might disagree with his policies. You might not have liked his policies. But I'm saying as far as a president.
He deported a ton of people, right?
ICE pretty good,
right. But I'm saying my point would be as far as a personality, I guess. Maybe, policies, some of the things that he did, of course. But I'm saying it is so interesting. Married kids, seemingly
also,
no controversy.
The thing he has in common with Trump is he makes people feel.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Right. So, and so it was a great time. And then we followed up that presidency with this. It's so bizarre. It's so bizarre to
it's
go from
the,
our first black president, you know, literally no personal controversy or any, you can't, maybe you disagreed with what he thought the country should do, but it wasn't morally ambiguous right. or bad.
He had
you
literally know what I mean? No scandals. Yes, exactly.
Right. No scandals or anything. And then we come to a president that just sexually Christians go, well, you know, boys will be boys or so, you know, like the whole world is changing. So that I know we're running out of time now, but and I didn't even get to my question. So we consider you a friend of the show. I hope you consider.
We'll come back. We'll do it.
Yeah, we'd like to have you back because I would love to get into the idea of how Trump and the president has even changed sexuality. Like the way like in some ways I've been thinking like in some ways, Me Too movement and more communication has happened. But at the same time, I think people are viewing sex even harder.
It's the best of times and the worst of times in my field, for sure. I also would love to come back anytime. I love talking to you guys because also I don't talk to people who come from where you come from that often. Like, this is actually really great for me also. I really love talking to you.
Really, you're awesome. You have your book is called Unscrewed. You have a podcast that I didn't know about, and I just started listening to it. It's great as well, called Unscrewed. Jacqueline Friedman. We really do. And you can go to jacquelinefriedman.com, right?
That's
your website as well?
That is correct, yeah.
Yep. So you can find her there. We love having you on. Thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Anytime.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.